Good afternoon. I would like to call the House Judiciary Committee meeting to order. Today is Friday, March 10th, and let the record reflect it is 1 p.m. Today we have present Representative Johnson, Vice Chair Allard, and myself, Chair Vance. I'd like to remind the committee members and those in the audience to please silence your cell phones. Staff assisting us today is Sophia Tenney with House Records and Talia Ames with the Juno LIO. We have with us Representative Eastman as well. Thank you for joining us. On today's agenda, the committee will hear two appointees to the Select Committee on Legislative Ethics as appointed by the Chief Justice of the Alaska Supreme Court. The second item on the agenda is the committee will hear House Bill 68, Crime of Sex and Human Trafficking by the Governor, as presented by the Criminal Division of the Alaska Department of Law. We've also been joined by Representative Gray. I will now go to our appointees to the Select Committee on Legislative Ethics, Ms. Deborah Fancher and Mr. Jerry McBeth. We will now go to Ms. Fancher first. If you could please state your name for the record and begin your remarks.
Well, good afternoon. My name is Deborah Fancher, and I'm just going to check because I've done this with teleconferencing. Can you guys all hear me?
Yes, we hear you very clearly. Please proceed.
Perfect. So my name is Deborah Fancher, and I was asked via email if I would tell the committee about my background, the duties of a committee member, and what my experience has been so far and why I wish to continue serving. So the easiest part is my background. I was brought to Alaska as a three-year-old kid, lived in Bush, Alaska. My mom was a public health nurse. My dad worked construction. And this is back right after the Alaska earthquake. So I've been in Alaska a long time as I am fast approaching 60. Lived in Bush, Alaska, went to elementary school in Chestachina and Gakona. If folks don't know where that is, Fine Toke and Valdez, and it's between the two. And then I headed out of the state to take advantage of a program that Alaska once had where they forgave half the amount of debt you incurred if you returned. So I went to Oregon State for 2 years and then to the University of Washington. My end game was to get into medical school. So after 4 years of working really hard, that didn't happen. So I had a whole lot of science. So the second plan became to work up on the North Slope and make lots of money and meet men. And I probably shouldn't say that on record, but that was the truth. So that then the price of oil in the 86 tanked. I had interviewed in September. The plan was to be hired. And by the time I had graduated, that was not going to be a possibility. So I stayed in Washington, got my teaching certificate. Had never planned on using it, came back to Alaska. I worked for the health department in Anchorage for 3 years, and then I fortuitously got a job with the Anchorage School District. I never thought I would love teaching. I taught in Anchorage for 25 years, and I love almost every day of my teaching experience. And then I retired. I continued to work part-time. I work 1 week a month for charter school doing science, which I love. My husband still works. I have two kids. They have a small business in Anchorage. One is 30, one is 27. I have a granddaughter that I spend time with. It's the only girl in my world, which has been great fun. And I think that about covers it. And if anybody has any questions about my background in a nutshell.
Thank you for that, Ms. Fancher. Could you please tell us why you are choosing to serve on the Committee of Legislative Ethics?
Legislative ethics is my push. I am not an attorney, and it is one of the things that it's been enjoyable to me. It's kept me connected with what's going on in politics, and it also is interesting to me to see how law and science and kind of the linear pieces of those are connected. So I am completely unqualified. I am not an attorney, but it has been enlightening to me to see how those kind of the thought process in law kind of follows the thought processes in science.
Thank you, Ms. Fancher. We have a question from Vice Chair Allard and then Representative Eason. Vice Chair Allard.
Thank you. And through the chair, Ms. Fancher, obviously you found your man. You are married.
I am married.
Okay, congratulations.
Almost 40 years with the same guy.
Well, I appreciate your sense of humor, and I love your resume. You have so much experience. And my question to you is, and actually your outside perspective and maybe not having that experience on the legal side of things would bring an outside look in. And I actually like that. Could you tell me if you plan on continuing and working in the education and if you're close to retiring?
I did retire. I was a tier one retiree. I worked in the Anchorage School District as a tier one retiree. And I have to tell you, I commend what you guys are doing in education. I hope you look at education, because I've had numerous people come to me and ask me to come back full time into teaching, which I'm not at this season in my life able to do because I watch my granddaughter 3 days a week. But the short answer is I teach 1 week a month for a charter school. The charter school is out of the Yukon-Kuskokwim School District, and I do science with homeschool / charter school kids, because science is a real difficult thing for parents sometimes to do in their kitchen or in their front yard. They don't have the tools, the background, and I have all that after 25 years in working with kids, and plus my bush kind of Alaska life. And so I'm going to continue working, and it gives me my mad money.
Thank you very much. And Ms. Fancher, you can expect a phone call from me. You sound like a great testifier. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Representative Eason.
Thank you to the chair. You know, just reading through the resume here, seems like a very extensive resume, I might add, but certainly have a lot of interesting things on here. I wanted to ask, you know, over the years, it's been difficult at times to recruit people to apply to serve on the Ethics Committee. And I'm just wondering kind of what's the status on that? Has there been a delayed process in filling vacancies on the committee, or has that issue kind of resolved?
You know, Representative Eastman, I don't know. I'm not part of the recruiting. I was recruited from a former parent. I'm not sure if the people on the committee are familiar with Berta Gardner. Berta Gardner, I had both of Berta Gardner's kids in my class at East. She was an amazing, involved parent, and we used to go on hikes. We have some very different views, but we always had a great time agreeing to disagree on a number of topics. And so Berta is the person that nominated me to the committee. When I spoke with Chief Justice Stowers years ago about my qualifications, as I mentioned earlier, I feel completely unqualified not being an attorney. I just feel like I'm outgunned, and I don't get hung up on the I's, the does, and the V's that are important in law. All that to be said, I don't know if it's difficult to recruit. When Berta asked me, I mentioned to both her and the Chief Justice that I felt unqualified, and the Chief Justice was quick to assure me that law and science were somewhat similar. I don't know. I still feel pretty unqualified, but speaking to, you know, are we going after attorneys? I think we have a new person up in Fairbanks who is associated with the university who will be fantastic. I guess the short answer to your question, which is the long answer, you never ask a teacher for a short answer. The short answer is I don't know.
Follow up, Representative Eason.
Thank you, through the chair. Appreciate your candor, Ms. Fancher. Now, as that non-attorney member that you had mentioned, you are, you know, one of the questions that we have periodically here in the legislature deals with, you know, staffing resources at our legislative legal branch. That's, you know, always something we're trying to get right. As a non-attorney member, have you had, you know, adequate and appropriate amounts of access to our attorneys that we do have on payroll to be able to answer your questions and address issues of legalities that, may come up. Obviously, having served on the committee myself, I know those issues come up, and it can be intimidating, looking at other members of the committee who are attorneys or administrators and attorney. Can you speak to have the attorneys that, we have on staff, they've been available when you've, sought them for advice and whatnot?
They have. And it has been, very enlightening listening to them. Again, as a classroom teacher, working with 30 high school kids with Bunsen burners and chemicals that could blind you, you're not intimidated by much. So I wouldn't say that I have been personally intimidated as far as availability. Absolutely. We were in a meeting just yesterday, and a gentleman by the name of, I believe the last name is Kirk, was absolutely available, answered all questions, and was very enlightening on some issues that we had going on. So, yes.
Follow up. Thank you. And also, can you speak to the frequency of committee meetings? That's also been something that's been a concern over the years as far as making, meetings happen in a timely manner based on members' schedules and conflicts and so forth. I know there's been, times of, over a year or more where the committee hasn't had meetings. How is that resolving now?
I can't speak to on a legislator's end. I think that the hard part is you have people that have lives. I mean, like I mentioned earlier, I have a granddaughter 3 days a week. I teach 1 week a month. And so you want to have meetings. And I know the administrator of our committee, Jerry Anderson, is frequently trying to poll us and say, what days are you available? He wants his committee people there. And that we've got, we had on our committee earlier, we had someone that was an engineer working in engineering, had his own engineering firm. So we're trying to schedule people. One of the people on our committee is a former attorney. He's up in Nome. We have somebody else in Fairbanks. We have two of us in Anchorage. So I think that the answer is there's a lot of moving parts to try to find five public members that are available. And then we have you guys' schedule in Juneau. So we're trying to figure out what day we can get to Juneau and we can all be there and or meet in Anchorage. And probably the short answer is I think it's as good as it can be considering the uniqueness of the committee and the fact that you have five private members and you also have people that are trying to deal with their legislative duties down in Juneau. So I don't think that that's any easy task. I don't know that it could be any better. I guess everything could be better. I don't know how to answer that. Could it be better? Yes. Could it be worse? Probably.
Follow up. Thanks. And can you also speak to us about the committee meeting either telephonically or in person and whether or not the committee's found a good balance there?
That is all dictated. I mean, whether we can, I have to tell you, now I'm old, right? I'm pushing 60. Many of you sitting on that committee are young and you grew up with technology. Personally, I don't think that you have a connection doing telephonic that you do face to face. I've worked with teachers. I've done teacher training. I've done student training. And I think it is horrific to try and teach a kindergarten and first grader how to read using a computer and a teacher. So, I mean, this is completely my personal take, but I think a face-to-face is very valuable and an electronic connection doesn't have that face-to-face that you can get. But again, it's not my generation. So do I think it's as good? No, because I'm pushing 60 and no, I don't think it's as good. I don't think it's as good with kids. I don't think it's as good with adults. I don't think you can read body language. I can't imagine how many of us have had an email go astray because people didn't interpret tone properly. There you go.
Thank you.
Vice Chair Allard. Did you have a further question?
Oh, no. Her testimony is just, I'm sorry. I like her.
Any further questions for Ms. Fancher? I just want to say thank you for Ms. Fancher. You have made a good impression on this committee for your candor and your sense of humor and just your honesty in the process. We truly appreciate that. So next.
Well, thank you guys for your public service. I know it's not always pleasant. I'm sure it's not always easy, but thank you very much on behalf of very grateful Alaskans.
We thank you for your willingness to serve on the committee, Ms. Fancher.
You're welcome. Have a wonderful day.
Next, we will hear from Mr. Gerald Jerry Macbeth. If you could please state your name for the record and begin your remarks on your experience and why you are choosing to serve on the Ethics Committee.
This is Jerry Macbeth, and you have copies of my resume, and it has a record of my work as a professor from 1970 to 2014 when I retired, but I'm semi-retired today. I'm still actively engaged in research and publications and service work, and service includes things such as in the last couple of years serving on this Select Committee on Legislative Ethics. In terms of me and my background, it's academic. But in terms of earlier parts of it and where they fit in Alaska, I came to Alaska in 76, but on my mother's side, I had three uncles, all of whom worked in Alaska, so they brought home stories about Alaska that I grew up on. One was a fisherman working in his boat off of Kodiak. One uncle was a supervisor of construction on the pipeline bridge over the Tanana River, and the third was a businessman working catalog sales, bringing Sears and Penny's operations to Fairbanks and Anchorage back in the 60s. So that's the background that I grew up with, and I'm in Alaska now. I'm retired. I could live anywhere in the world, but Alaska is where my wife is employed. Jennifer is a plant pathologist, professor of that and biotechnology at UAF, and we have a home here, and in other personal aspects of background, I have two adult children and two lovely granddaughters. One is 25 and one is 6 and a half, and she's a firecracker. In terms of differences between my background and the standard academic background, I've been pretty strongly involved in local government and local politics. I was on the school board in Fairbanks for 9 years, on the planning commission for about 5 years, and ran to the borough assembly once, and I, fortunately for them and me, didn't make it. And I'm still strongly interested in Alaska politics. I'm a political scientist, and that's what we study. It's how decisions are made, campaigns and elections that bring people into office, and their behavior in institutions of government as they work. So I don't know if you want me to stop at my background or tell you about the other questions, duties, and experience so far and why I want to continue to serve, but I'll leave it up to you.
Please continue. We'd love to hear that as well. And if there's any further questions from committee members on your background, I think they will pursue that. But we'd love to hear your choice of serving on the Ethics Committee.
Well, my experience so far is, it's a challenge, because, initially when I come into an issue presented before the committee, I have, sort of my background on that issue or topic, but I've mostly, at least in early stages, kept my mouth shut and observed what is going on and what the committee is engaged in. Because, I'm a member of a group, and it's a group decision-making process that pays a lot of attention to, how individual views sit and adjust with one another. And so that's what I've been, engaged in. I have to thank Jerry Anderson, Jackie, the members of the staff, and other public members, Skip and Joyce, and, Connor and Deb, and they've taught me quite a bit, and I think the central thing that I've learned to date, and it's just been 2 years and we haven't had all that many meetings, is that we don't write the rules. We are not legislators. That's not our job. I think it's important to keep that in mind when we sit on a committee. What we really do is we inform legislators and legislative staff about what the rules on ethics are as they pertain to them. And training sessions provided annually. And we offer a lot of informal advice, and Jerry Anderson and Jackie are mostly responsible for this part of it, and then until they take it to us. And really the meat of our work is doing the formal advisory opinions and then investigating complaints, dealing with requests for information, but mostly dealing with and attempting to resolve complaints as issues. And where I sit in this is I'm not law trained, but I'm a professor of political science. We study laws. We have a sub-discipline in constitutional law and statutory law. And sometimes we hire political scientists who are law trained, as well as having degrees in political science. Although the doctorate in law is considered equivalent, certainly among lawyers, not necessarily among political scientists, to be as good as a PhD in political science. But this is just, you know, bickering among the members of a relatively small fraternity. I guess what I bring, because I have an understanding of the law, we work with the law and its expression in institutions all the time in political science, and I have a great respect for people who are making the laws and I don't call them politicians. I call them political leaders. And I have great respect for the legislative body of the state of Alaska and have observed it for the number of years that I've been in the state. And I think I want to continue to serve on the committee because if the reputation of the legislature is not good pertaining to its decisions and its processes especially, and if there's perception in the public mind that there's individual self-serving action afoot and not the public interest foremost in all decisions that are made, that tarnishes the reputation of the institution as a whole. And I think the Select Committee on Ethics helps importantly in that respect, and I'd like to contribute my skills and abilities to the process. And there must be questions about that.
Questions from committee members. Representative Eastman.
Thank you, through the chair. Thanks, sir, for your background and walking us through some of that information. You know, I know society has changed a bit over the years, but I also know that some of the members of the committee haven't. We've got a number of members who've served on that particular committee for more than two decades. I'm just wondering, as someone who's been an alternate on the committee now to be a full member, I believe, do you, are there enough people out there willing to put in for the position, or do you feel like maybe if you didn't, there wouldn't be anybody to fill the spot?
Oh, I think that this is a recruitment question, and legislators themselves, I talk to people and see if they might be interested in serving, and I hope it's an open process, and a number of potential nominees are in the pipeline, but I don't know anything about that.
My question is for you specifically. Do you feel if you didn't put in for this position today that there would be enough people there who would do so, or do you feel like maybe if you didn't that the seat would go vacant for some period of time?
Oh, I don't know. I think if you decided not to confirm me, they would find somebody else, I'm sure. I don't know how easy or difficult that would be, because I'm not familiar with that aspect of the recruitment process. But I don't think Deb mentioned that she's not law trained. I'm not law trained. But I'm certainly a great respecter of the law, and I think that there are other people, and there are no explicit qualifications mentioning that a law proficiency is essential.
Follow up. Thank you, through the chair. And also on the topic of changing society, I know there have been, you know, some in the public who have shown a greater appetite over the last couple of years, especially to use our legal systems to accomplish political aims, you know, even so far as to file lawsuits against sitting legislators and so forth. I'm just wondering, is that something that the committee is aware of and has been following closely, or is that not something that's come up?
It was. I'm sure members of the committee are familiar with it because this is part of the, you know, a series of recent interpretations. I believe the phrase used is called weaponizing the law. I don't believe that this is a factual statement of the legal profession today. Lawyers, like political scientists, like professionals in general, have obligations to search for, seek out, and find the truth.
Follow up. Thank you. And since it is something that the committee's aware on, have you had any thoughts about the fact that of all of the sitting legislators in this state who've been subjects to lawsuits in the last 2 years, that all four of them have been on one particular party?
Well, I don't. Are you asking me to explain a situation, and from what perspective would you like me to explain it? From an analytical perspective, which is why there is a minority of three, four, or five legislators in the House, and who are Republicans, but are not in the majority that has Republicans and a couple of Democrats and a couple of independents. So, I mean, I'm not clear as to the focus of the question.
Follow up. Thank you. Well, I ask you the question because you're applying today to be on what is effectively a member of a law enforcement entity enforcing our Ethics Act. And my question is to your awareness and to the extent that you know other committee members' awareness of the fact that all four of the legislators who have been had personally been sued as legislators in the last 2 years, they've all belonged to one particular party. Were you aware of that? Is that a concern?
I am aware of the attempt to reach just conclusions based on the evidence presented by members of the Select Committee on Ethics, as I have observed them. So I don't have a list in front of me of all of the people who've been sent, and you know, it's hard to talk about us as ethics cops, right? Because we have, we work in coordination with the, APOC, right? And APOC focuses, of course, on campaigns and elections, but the laws, as they have developed in this area, bring the Select Committee on Legislative Ethics together with, APOC on several occasions, in several instances. But in watching how people on the committee observed, I have respect for them and for their attempt to ascertain answers to what have been filed as questions and concerns and complaints. And you have made a series of statements, Representative Eastman, that I'm not sure that they're quite general, and I don't have the full panoply of data in front of me to answer them, but I'm telling you what I've observed and what I've seen on paper. And it seems to me that the actions that I've observed are justifiable in terms of dealing with the situation and the issue presented to the committee.
Any follow-up?
Follow-up.
Thank you. And having worked with the committee since 2021 in your resume, you've got a kind of a rare opportunity talking to the legislature now. Are there some areas of our Ethics Act? I know it hasn't been changed in quite some time. Are there some areas where you think we ought to give attention and add either substance or clarity?
Well, I think on several occasions when this issuing advisory opinions, the committee comes forward with suggestions for areas where the statutes might be clarified. And this is, these are just in the nature of suggestions because we're not legislators. And as I mentioned, it's quite important for members of the committee to understand that they are not legislators. They are implementing sections and parts of the law. So I think the answer to your question is yes, there is a provision in our procedures for making recommendations to legislators. But it's not the job of the committee to make global statements, which might be vacuous, about this, that, or the other, in my view.
Thank you.
Further questions for Mr. Rickbeck? Representative Groh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just more of a comment. Thank you, Mr. Professor Macbeth, for your service and your willingness to serve now. I have read some of your work before, a fraction of your very substantial product. And thank you, as I said, for your service and your willingness to serve.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you. I have never seen an 18-page resume, and you have definitely had, there's a depth and breadth of work here, and we appreciate your willingness to serve on this committee. Any further questions? Well, in accordance, thank you, Mr. Macbeth, for taking the time with us today. In accordance with AS 24.60.131, the House Judiciary Committee held a hearing on the appointees, the Select Committee on Legislative Ethics, Deborah Fancher and Gerald Jerry Macbeth. A signature on this report does not reflect any intent by any of the members to vote for or against the ratification of the individuals during any further sessions. We will now take a brief at ease to sign the reports. Back on record. I want to thank once again Ms. Deborah Fancher and Jerry Macbeth for their willingness to serve on these committees because it has become a challenge to have members of the public serve on the variety of committees and boards, and we greatly appreciate everyone for their willingness to come forward and take part of the very important process. So we will now hear House Bill 68, Crime of Sex and Human Trafficking, by the Governor, as presented by the Criminal Division of the Alaska Department of Law in its first hearing. So I'd like to welcome to the table Deputy Attorney General Mr. John Skidmore. If you would please state your name for the record and begin walking the committee through this bill.
Good afternoon, members of House Judiciary. For the record, my name is John Skidmore. I'm the Deputy Attorney General for the Criminal Division of the State of Alaska Department of Law, and I'm here today to introduce HB 68 to you all. This is a bill that addresses Alaska's human and sex trafficking laws, which are both in need of updating. But before I get into the specifics of the bill, if you would allow me to provide a little bit of background and details on these types of crimes, I think it'll be useful. Trafficking of other humans, whether it be for labor or for sex, is conduct which should have no place in our society. These are crimes of exploitation, plain and simple. The purpose of this conduct? Greed. Nothing more, nothing less. Profiting at the expense of their victims. And as our U.S. Department of Justice, Department of State notes, that these crimes are, and I quote, human rights abuse that compromise national and economic security, that undermine the rule of law, and harm communities everywhere. Estimates for these types of crimes for the number of victims range somewhere between 27 million and 40 million worldwide. The profit that's estimated from this? $150 billion, billion with a B, per year. That makes sex and human trafficking second only to the illicit drug trade in the world in terms of profitability. Unlike drugs, which must be made or produced, when one is trafficking in other humans for labor or for sex, you don't have to make or produce every time you want to turn a profit. You just abuse their human rights again and again and again. And this generates a profit for those individuals. This truly makes human and sex trafficking what many have called modern-day slavery. It is a crime against other humans. And that leads us directly into the bill that's in front of you. The first thing that the bill does is that it updates our sex trafficking laws by moving them from 1166 to 1141. Now, what in the world difference does that make to move something from crimes of public indecency to crimes against a person? It's a question that I was asked previously. So let me offer you a similar explanation to what I previously provided. In 1978, Alaska adopted our statutes that addressed prostitution. And when it addressed prostitution back in 1978, there was crimes for promoting prostitution. Not sex trafficking, just prostitution. And so at that time, it made sense to group them as crimes against public decency. However, as a Loyola Marymount article from 2019 indicates, our country really only began to pay attention to what was going on with human and sex trafficking around 2013. And when they did, both the federal government and many states have started to update their laws to more appropriately reflect what's going on for these types of crimes. And when we talk about the difference of something being classified in Alaska statutes between 1166 and 1141, well, let me give you a small snippet of what that means. For example, in Alaska Statute 1245.042, defendants can compel victims to undergo mental exams unless they're victims of an 1141 crime, a crime against a person. In 1261.010 and 1261.120, those are statutes that deal with the release of information like phone numbers and addresses of victims, except for victims of crimes of 1141, crimes against a person. 1250.020 talks about the ability to temporarily detain individuals when they have been suspected of crimes against a person in 1141. Sentencing laws. 1255.011, victims and defendants can make sentencing recommendations, except defendants don't get to make those same sentencing recommendations in crimes that are 1141 crimes. 1255.027G1 talks about electronic monitoring credit that is achieved pre-trial, except for crimes against persons, 1141. 1255.127 talks about concurrent versus consecutive sentencing and authorizes concurrent sentencing in most instances, except you know, crimes against a person, 1141 crimes. These are just but a snippet of the types of statutes, the types of decisions that you, the legislature, have made about how crimes against persons should be treated differently, because they are crimes in which another human being is harmed. And when you talk about human or sex trafficking, those clearly make sense to be in 1141. Crimes against human trafficking currently are in 1141. It's just the sex trafficking that are not. And so one of the primary things that needs to be done is to shift those so that they are truly characterized for what they are, a crime against a person. Second, it's important to separate the concepts of human and sex trafficking. In some instances and in some laws, there is overlap. But that overlap should not exist, because in this bill, what happens is we differentiate between sex trafficking and labor trafficking. And you don't want to have that overlap, because when you treat them differently, if you provide different penalties or sentences associated with them, you cannot have that overlap. Otherwise, you run into a legal provision that says if there are two things that are similar, then the defendant gets the benefit of that which is more lenient. Basically, undoing or making it meaningless when you've characterized something as more serious. So you need to draw the appropriate distinctions if you truly intend to deal with them as separate concepts. Second, our laws, written, updated back in 2007 to try to address sex trafficking, attempted to describe what was involved in sex trafficking as it was understood at that time. However, here we are over a decade later, and our understanding of what's involved in these types of crimes has evolved as well. If you look at what the Department of Justice tells us about these types of crimes, there are really three areas that they look at. The acts themselves, which talks about recruiting, harboring, transporting, providing, obtaining, patronizing, or soliciting another to engage in commercial sex. Or you have the means. And when we talk about the means, it's how does a trafficker cause someone to engage in this conduct? By force, fraud, or coercion. And that can include threats of serious harm, psychological harm, reputational harm, threats to others, debt manipulation. Our current laws are not adequate to address all of these various ways that we now understand human and sex trafficking occurs. This bill changes that. It updates it to include those concepts within the bill for both types of crimes. The other thing that it takes into account is the types of victims that you're going to see for human trafficking. What our State Department for the U.S. tells us, human trafficking victims can be of any age, race, ethnicity, sex, gender identity, sexual orientation, nationality, immigration status, cultural background, religion, social economic class, and educational attainment. In the United States, individuals vulnerable to human trafficking include children in the child welfare and juvenile justice systems, including foster care, runaway and homeless youth, unaccompanied foreign national children without lawful immigration status, individuals seeking asylum, American Indians and Alaska Natives, particularly women and girls, individuals with substance abuse issues, racial and ethnic minorities, migrant laborers, including undocumented workers and participants in visa programs for temporary workers, foreign national domestic workers in diplomatic households, persons with limited English proficiency, persons with disabilities, LGBTQI and plus individuals, and individuals of intimate partner violence or other forms of domestic violence. These are all the individuals that are more likely to become victims because of the way trafficking works and the ways in which the traffickers attempt to manipulate others. And I think our understanding of these and understanding that this is a crime that is motivated by greed, by money. Without the demand, these crimes wouldn't exist. And so what does that mean? Best practices indicate that the demand side of this equation must be addressed. And in this bill, that's done in two ways. First, it creates a new crime called a patron of a victim of sex trafficking, which occurs either when the defendant has reckless disregard that the person they're purchasing sex from is a victim of sex trafficking, or second, when the person is under a particular age, they are automatically deemed to then be a victim of sex trafficking. And that age, I believe, is 18 in the bill. Second, when we deal with prostitution, prostitution criminalizes both the selling and the purchasing of sex. This bill does not change what the penalties are associated for selling under the crime of prostitution. What it does address is the purchasing. Instead of being a B misdemeanor, it elevates it to an A misdemeanor. It does not dictate what the sentence should be. It simply says it would be a misdemeanor, which increases the potential range. And then second, it also addresses a concept that is found throughout our criminal statutes, which is that of the repeat offender. If somebody is convicted multiple times, so you get to your third or greater offense within a period of 5 years, instead of simply being a misdemeanor, then that prostitution conviction can become a felony. Last but not least, what the bill does is it also attempts to follow other best practices that are outlined in much of the literature that you'll find on this topic. And that's the concept of creating safe harbor for victims. Victims are often forced into committing other criminal conduct. Prostitution is one example, but the possession or the use of drugs is another way in which victims are often manipulated or forced into trafficking, and that can also result in convictions for possession of those drugs. These are both the types of crimes that this bill creates for the first time in Alaska statute, the ability for a victim to have removed from their record. Why? Well, the criminal law is really based on someone engaging in criminal conduct of their own volition. But if somebody else is forcing them, compelling them to engage in that conduct, then they really shouldn't be held accountable for it. And so while in most other instances, I would simply be in front of you recommending something like a certificate of rehabilitation for someone that's paid their debt, in these instances, it's very different. This person never had a debt to pay. They were forced to commit that conduct. And that means that whether it was an adult conviction or a juvenile adjudication, they ought to have the ability to have that removed from the record. And that's another part or another provision that's within this bill. Those are some of the highlights. Because the bill is far more detailed than simply those highlights, I want to ensure that we provide you with a sectional analysis, which was done by Ms. Schroeder, and then I'd be happy to answer any questions from the committee about the bill.
Before we continue with any questions, I would like the sectional analysis because it is a robust bill, and I think it will clarify some things, and then we can continue with questions. Thank you, Mr. Skidmore. Thank you, Ms. Schroeder. Please state your name for the record and continue with the sectional.
For the record, Casey Schroeder, Assistant Attorney General for the Criminal Division at the Department of Law. So as Mr. Skidmore outlined, one of the things we're doing with the bill is moving sex trafficking from 1166 to 1141. That requires a number of conforming changes. So that's something you're going to hear me say over and over again. So that is a lot of the bill. A lot of the bill is conforming changes. Beginning with Section 1, that statute is being amended to reflect the new citations of sex trafficking in 1141 rather than 1166. Section 2 is incorporating victims of sex trafficking into the privilege statute so that we are treating victims of sex trafficking, victims of domestic violence, and victims of sexual assault. Those communications would be confidential if they're made to a victim counselor. Section 3 amends the conspiracy statute. There is a definition of serious felony offense in the conspiracy statute, and we are just, again, correcting that cross-reference to the 1141 statute. Section 4 is the crux of the bill and where we begin the new sex trafficking statutes. That's on page 3. Sex trafficking in the first degree would be when somebody causes another person to engage in commercial sexual act through the use of force or threat of force if the victim is under 20 years of age or in that person's legal custody. It also covers managing, supervising, or controlling a prostitution enterprise or place of prostitution. And sex trafficking in the first degree is an unclassified felony. Sex trafficking in the second degree is when a person induces or causes a person to engage in a commercial sexual act. Sex trafficking in the second degree is a Class A felony. Sex trafficking in the third degree is when somebody provides resources in furtherance of sex trafficking, and that is a B or C felony depending on the value of the resources provided. So if the value is over $200 or more, it's going to be a B felony, and if it's less than that, it would be a C felony. And then on page 4, about line 7, we have a new statute. 1141.355 is patron of a victim of sex trafficking. And this is when somebody solicits commercial sexual acts with reckless disregard that the person they're soliciting from is a victim of sex trafficking. This statute would also apply if the person solicited is under 18 years of age. This conduct is a B felony if the person is underage, the victim is underage, or a C felony if the victim is an adult. And then 1141.357 on page 4 towards the bottom are the factors. These factors inform what inducing or causing means. And it could be anything from destroying or concealing a passport, threatening to report a person to a governmental agency, threatening to collect a debt, deception, instilling in a person fear that lodging, food, or clothing or medication would be withheld from a person. So it's broader, and this section outlines what types of conduct could be inducing or causing. And it reflects how these crimes actually occur. Section 5 is human trafficking. Human trafficking in the first degree is when someone induces or causes another person to engage in adult entertainment or labor by force, or the victim is under 20. And human trafficking in the first degree is an unclassified felony. Human trafficking in the second degree is inducing or causing another person to engage in adult entertainment or labor by, and again, the list here at the bottom of page 5 is consistent with the list that we find in sex trafficking for inducing or causing, withholding a passport, withholding food or lodging, withholding medication, that type of thing. If you're doing that to get somebody to engage in adult entertainment or labor, that would be human trafficking in the second degree. And human trafficking in the second degree is a Class A felony. Human trafficking in the third degree, again, is providing resources in furtherance of human trafficking. And again, it's broken down by the value of resources that is provided in furtherance of human trafficking. So if it's a $200 or more, it'll be a B felony. And if it's less than that, it'll be a C felony. There's also an applicability section on page 6, 1141.367, that protects people who are engaging in normal interactions with children, ensuring that that's not a violation of human trafficking. So if you say, I'm not going to give you this pair of jeans unless you shovel the walkway, that is not human trafficking. That's not what we mean there. And that language there clarifies that. 1141.368 is corroboration of certain testimony not required. This is a restatement of current law. This language is also in current law, and so we've just carried it over. 1141.369 is forfeiture, and it just makes any property used in furtherance of human or sex trafficking can be forfeited. Section 9 on page 7, this amends the coercion statute, and basically it just says, this is a conforming amendment, it just says when we're talking about human and sex trafficking, we're not talking about coercion, so it's separating those two statutes out. Section 10 amends the prostitution statute. In the prostitution statute, there is a bar to prosecution if we learn about the prostitution conduct because the person engaging in the conduct is reporting a more serious offense, then they are immune basically from being prosecuted for prostitution. So there's a number of offenses which that person can report, and we're both correcting cross-references from 1166 to 1141, so these people can report sex trafficking. And then we're also adding patron of a victim of sex trafficking to that. So if somebody could report a sex trafficking crime without being at risk of being prosecuted for prostitution themselves. Section 11 on page 9 amends the penalty provision for the prostitution statute. So the person who is selling the sex would be guilty of a B misdemeanor. The person purchasing would be guilty of an A misdemeanor. And if the person purchasing is convicted 3 times within 5 years, that would be a C felony. Section 12 makes clear that any property used in furtherance of purchasing sex for the, under the prostitution statute can be forfeited. Section 13 amends the classification statute, and again, this is just a conforming change, adding human trafficking to that statute because we've raised the classification of that statute. Section 14 is the same thing, just adding human trafficking to the classification statute. Page 11, Section 15 is adding a bunch of definitions to the definition section in Title 11. So adult entertainment, commercial sexual act, services or resources, sexual conduct, all of those things are, those terms are used in the sex trafficking statutes. And so those are defined in the definition section for Title 11. Section 16 is a statute of limitations statute. And again, this is mostly cleanup. Sex trafficking in the first or second degree and human trafficking in the first or second degree, there would be no statute of limitations. So those prosecutions could be brought at any time. For sex trafficking in the third degree and human trafficking in the third degree, the statute of limitations would be 10 years. Section 17 is a conforming change to the authorization to intercept communications statute. Again, just reflecting the new citations for sex trafficking in the first and second degree and the changes made to human trafficking.
I'd like to let the record reflect that we've been joined by our guest representative Ruffridge to the committee. Welcome. Please continue.
Section 18 is amending, again, the privilege communication statute, again, to treat sex trafficking victims the same as sexual assault and domestic violence victims as in regards to communications to counselors. Section 19 is the fines statute, so the fines that can be levied upon conviction. And again, this is a conforming change reflecting the changes made to human trafficking and sex trafficking. Section 20 is a suspended entry of judgment statute. And what this says is if you've been charged with human trafficking or sex trafficking, you are not eligible for a suspended entry of judgment. Section 21 is the suspended imposition of sentence statute, a similar but slightly different statute. And again, if you've been charged with sex trafficking or human trafficking, you are not eligible for suspended imposition of sentence. Page 15, Section 22 is the sentencing statutes. 1255-125B is the sentencing for unclassified felonies, and because human trafficking in the first degree is now an unclassified, is being added to that statute. That is a conforming change. Section 23 is, again, the sentencing statutes, and these are the sex offense sentences, and so we're adding sex trafficking to the sex offense sentencing statutes. You'll also see a number of cleanup changes because the last time the statute was changed, some of those cross-references were missed, and so we are trying to clean that up using this as an opportunity to do that. Section 24 is on page 19. That is the misdemeanor sentencing statute, and that statute says that the person has been convicted of misdemeanor purchasing sex twice, they need to be sentenced to at least 72 hours in jail. Section 25 amends the definition of most serious felony to reflect the changes in cross-references for human trafficking and sex trafficking, again, a conforming change. Section 26 amends the definition of sexual felony to reflect that we are now treating sex trafficking as a sexual felony, and we are also adding patron of a victim of sex trafficking. Section 27 amends the definition of serious offense in regards to criminal background checks. And again, this is fixing the cross-references to reflect the movement of sex trafficking. Section 28 amends the definition of sex offense in regards to a registrable sex offense. So every crime listed under this definition is a registrable sex offense. And we are just making sex trafficking in the first and second degree and patron of a victim of sex trafficking a registrable sex offense. And that change actually occurs on page 22 at the top of the page. And again, we're also fixing a cross-reference there. Section 29 is the vacation of judgment. So a person can have their judgment for for prostitution or low-level drug possession vacated if they can show that they were a victim of sex trafficking at the time that the offense was occurred. And all of those statutes added there just outline the procedure for that. On page 24, sections 30 through 35 add sex trafficking and victims of sex trafficking under the purview of the Council of Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault, again continuing the theme of treating victims of sex trafficking similarly to victims of domestic violence and victims of sexual assault. And that's sections 30 through 35. Section 36 is on page 27. This amends the Violent Crimes Compensation Board to add victims of sex trafficking as a group that can receive compensation through the Violent Crimes Compensation Board. Section 37 says that a public defender can be appointed to assist someone in obtaining a vacation of judgment. Section 38, this statute talks about who cannot be a school bus driver. And so if the offense that they've been convicted of is on that list, they cannot be a school bus driver. We are correcting cross-references. So people who have been convicted of human trafficking and sex trafficking, as well as patron of a victim of sex trafficking, cannot be a school bus driver. Section 39 is, again, a conforming change to the Landlord-Tenant Act, just correcting just reflecting the movement from 1166 to 1141 for sex trafficking. Section 40 says that if a person has had their conviction vacated, they are eligible for the permanent fund dividend from that year forward, that they don't get to go back, but from that year forward, they would be eligible for a permanent fund dividend. Section 41 talks about administrative subpoenas, and again, it is having sex trafficking in the first through third degree eligible for administrative subpoenas. Section 42 is a mandatory reporter statute, again, correcting the cross-reference, reflecting the movement from 1166 to 1141 for sex trafficking. Section 43 is a delinquency statute, and it talks about what types of crimes will be open to the public, and certain very serious offenses can be open to the public in those circumstances. And in this case, it would be sex trafficking in the first and second degree. Section 44, again, talks about information that can be disclosed to the public in relation to delinquency proceedings, and again, it's sex trafficking in the first and second degree, and this is consistent with current law. Section 45 is the Child in Need of Aid statutes, and again, we're correcting cross-references there, reflecting the movement of sex trafficking from 1166 to 1141. Bottom of page 31, section 46 is the repealer section. Section 47 is the applicability section. The bill is applied prospectively. Just in general, all of the changes will apply prospectively. There is a delayed effective date for the vacation of judgment, and that's found in section 48 on page 33. The delayed effective date would be January 1, 2024, so just a few additional months, as the rest of the bill would become effective July 1, 2023, and that's on section 49.
Thank you, Ms. Schroeder. I do have a couple of questions that I think were discussed, but I just kind of want to clarify some terms, because there's a lot of different terms here that I think we often get conflated. And the first one that I want you to just clarify for the record and members and the public watching is the definition of adult entertainment versus commercial sex acts.
Madam Chair, the definitions are found on page 11. And adult entertainment talks about simulated acts, so simulated sexual penetration, simulated lewd touching, simulated bestiality, but it's simulated. We don't want to go into actual, because actual would then be the actual act itself, would have then moved the conduct over into sex trafficking. Commercial sexual acts are sexual acts for which anything of value is received by the person. However, anything of value does not include compensation for reasonably apportioned shared services of a residence. So if two sex workers are living together and they're sharing rent, that doesn't count. for the purposes of that definition. And a sexual act is sexual penetration or sexual contact.
Thank you for that. I think that was like best simplistic definition. Would you clarify the differences in statute as it applies to this bill? Because they're clearly in different sections. Some adult entertainment is legal. Commercial sex acts are not, correct?
Commercial sexual acts and related are what we use. That's the term we use in sex trafficking. There are prostitution statutes now, and they use a slightly different term. They use commercial sexual conduct. And you will see both those terms used in this bill because we wanted to make sure that we preserved the prostitution statutes as much as possible, that conduct, and not made things that may be currently legal, illegal as far as trafficking, because we do use a broader term for trafficking. The main thing that I can think of is that commercial sexual conduct, which is you currently find in the prostitution statutes, mainly involves touching below the waist. And commercial sexual act is broader and could include touching above the waist, so the breast, the female breast.
Vice Chair Allen, you had a question.
I do. Thank you, and through the chair. Can you flip to page 11? Is that what we're on currently? Can you, ma'am, please read section 15, exactly what A and B mean? I see it. I'm reading it. I think I know what it means. Can you give me an example? I know.
So through the chair, Representative Allard, those portions of the definition of adult entertainment talk about removing clothes or other items that hide the person's body or dancing in any other manner exhibiting the individual's body in a completely or almost completely unclothed state. That is a strip club. I don't know the proper term for that, but that's what adult entertainment is, that definition is targeted at. So what we were saying in the bill is if you're forcing somebody to engage in that act, those acts, that is going to be human trafficking as opposed to sex trafficking.
Follow up?
Please, may I do a follow up through the chair? Okay. So that means someone else. What if a person, an adult, is doing that in front of a child?
Through the chair, Representative Allard, if you're talking about indecent exposure,
is that okay?
That would be a different crime. That would be a different crime, and it matters how young the child is.
Even, yeah, just a quick follow-up. Even with parental consent? I know.
Through the chair to Representative Allard, I'd have to look at the indecent exposure statute. We may not have a mental state there, but that's not something we generally charge.
Okay, can you just let me know?
Sure.
Send it to my office. Okay, thank you. I know you want to follow up on
that.
Well,
I'm tracking and just wanting to understand the distinction of what this area of law covers. And I'm wanting to make sure that as we deal with human trafficking and sex trafficking and prostitution and adult entertainment, they're all different pockets, but they... A lot of them run together in my mind, but we have to deal with them differently in the law. And on this section of adult entertainment, according to this legal definition, for them to be charged, for it to fall under adult entertainment, do they have to be employed?
Chair Vance, the definition does say employed, contracted, or permitted. So employment would be one of the things that would qualify, yes.
Okay. I have a couple of other definitions, but while we're on this thought, does member Representative Eastman, did you have questions while we're on this page?
Thank you, through the chair. I was just curious, now you mentioned the age of the child earlier. And is there a lower benchmark as far as age? Is there an age at which you're too young to be considered a victim? Or is it only an upper threshold?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, do you mean a victim of sex trafficking?
Well, I think we were talking a minute ago about indecent exposure and that type of thing. You mentioned that the age was a factor. I just wondered, is that only an upper threshold, or is there a window?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, it was an upper threshold. I was thinking of, I think it's 16, but I really would want to look at the statute in front, and I don't have it in front of me, but it's an upper threshold.
While we're here on the definitions on page 11, do we have definitions for prostitution and sex trafficking? Because they are distinctly different things. Or is that listed here? Could you reference a page?
Chair Vance, the definition of sex trafficking really would be the statute itself. So if you want to... The core definition of sex trafficking, I would look at sex trafficking in the second degree. That's on page 3. And for the definition of prostitution, again, I would look to the crime of prostitution itself, and that's in 1166-100.
Thank you. I think having clarification of these different things as we move through this bill is going to help us understand how we need to apply different areas of law. That's why I asked these questions from the very beginning. So Representative Eastman has a question.
Thank you. I actually had a similar question that for the benefit of the public, especially, can someone articulate what is the difference between legally when we talk about prostitution versus when we talk about sex trafficking? What are the distinctions?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, the main distinction is that sex trafficking is when somebody is forcing someone else to engage in the conduct. Prostitution would be when an individual themselves is selling sex. So that's the difference. The trafficking has a third party involved.
Follow-up?
Follow-up, thank you. And you'd mentioned earlier that the withholding was part of one of the distinctions. Specifically, you mentioned like food and lodging. How are we using withholding? Is it withholding if an employer says, I'm going to fire you, and then you're going to be out on the street and you're not going to have food and lodging, or does it have a more particular meaning?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, it would need to be a little more direct than that. We're not intending to interfere with employers who are engaging in normal legal conduct. Obviously, employers can decide who and who does not work for them. The withholding lodging and food was to be targeted towards if you don't engage in this sexual conduct or sexual act with this person, this other person, I'm going to not house you. You're not going to have a place to live. You can't live with me anymore, that type of thing. It's an immediate effect.
Yes, and earlier you talked about the difference between things that are simulated versus actual acts. And I just want to know, in order for a particular illicit conduct to fall in one category or the other, does it matter whether or not someone perceives that it's the act versus perceiving that it's a simulation of the act? I'm just wondering, there might be some confusion on whether or not something is actually happening versus being simulated. And is that something that is impacted by what someone sees or thinks they see?
Through the chair, to Representative Eastman, no. If you're talking about someone engaging in some sort of illusion where it's not really happening, but the observer might think it's happening, no. That would still be simulated. The actual or simulated is what the actual person engaging in the act is experiencing.
Thank you.
Representative Grove.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a number of questions, but I'd like to start out with a more basic one about a particular matter in this bill. There's a provision for vacation in this bill, and it has a later effective date than the other provisions. You might have explained the rationale for that difference, but if you did, I missed it. Could you offer it?
Through the chair, Representative Grove, I did not explain that, so I thank you for the question. this bill, this is probably the third year that this bill has been in front of the legislature. And last year in the Senate, I believe, and I don't want to speak for them because I believe Ms. Mead is in the room, I believe the court system asked for a delayed effective date for that. And she can jump up and say I'm wrong if she
Maybe she could answer that, if that'd be helpful.
Ms. Mead, if you would join us at the table.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Nancy Mead, General Counsel for the Alaska Court System. To address that question, Ms. Schroeder is correct. I'm not certain exactly when it was added, but that provision will affect processes within the court system. So we did request a delayed effective date to make sure that we could implement that.
Okay. Thank you. I don't have one. I do have other questions for Ms. Schroeder, but thank you very much.
Yeah, please continue.
Ms. Schroeder, additionally, there is going to a substantially different section of the bill. As you have said, there's a creation of a new crime of patron of a victim of sex trafficking. And there are two two branches of that. One is this is from if a person commits this crime in one way, if they solicit a commercial sexual act from a person who's under 18 years of age. I'm particularly interested in the other branch, which is a person commits a commercial sexual act with reckless disregard to the person engaging in the sexual act as a victim of sex trafficking. Can you talk more about the kind of factual scenarios or defenses which might arise here in this particular potential prosecution of that particular branch of the crime?
Through the chair, Representative Groh, you've hit on a good point. We're not suggesting that this is the type of thing that we're going to be able to routinely prove. However, where we could prove it, we would like the tools to be able to address it. Someone would have to have some reason to think that the person that they've solicited from is a victim of sex trafficking, and that can look any number of ways. That could look like the employer is arranging for things, is standing outside the door while things are supposed to be occurring, seems to be domineering, that type of thing. The victim may appear to be strung out on drugs. You know, all those factors, something that somebody would notice and be like, I don't know if this is like all on the up and up. But again, we would have to prove that beyond a reasonable doubt. So this is not something that we expected that we would be able to use very often. However, we would like the tool to be able to use it where we can prove it.
Thank you. Follow up, please. And Schroeder, I don't know if this question is for you or more for Mr. Skidmore. I do generally want to state that this is the context for the question. I very much want Alaska law to be very tough on the sex trafficking. On the other hand, I do not think that Alaska law needs to devote a lot of resources against prostitution in which is voluntary. And it's well known that because they come to the Capitol here that there are some sex workers in Alaska who have identified themselves and they've been publicized as well, who are consenting adults and may have been in this line of work for decades in some cases. But I wanted to have more of a understanding of the Department of Law's position on drawing that line and how that would work in the context of this lengthy a bill with a whole bunch of provisions.
Madam Chair, I think that Mr. Skidmore probably can provide a more fuller explanation, so I'm going to turn it on over to him.
Thank you, Mr. Skidmore. Please state your name for the record.
Again, for the record, I am John Skidmore, the Deputy Attorney General for the Criminal Division for the State of Alaska Department of Law. And if I may, Representative Groh, would you restate your question so that I make sure I answer it correctly?
Given that I'm substantially and strongly interested in having the State of Alaska in its prosecution arm of the Department of Law take a very powerful stance and devote substantial resources to fight sex trafficking,
mm-hmm.
but on the other hand, do not think that there should be a lot of resources devoted to fighting prostitution which is engaged in by consenting adults, given the substantial amount of violent, you know, crime in our state.
Mm-hmm.
I would like to understand better the philosophy of this bill in terms of drawing lines and devotion of resources.
Through the chair, Representative Groh, I would tell you that this bill does precisely what you're describing. It takes sex trafficking and requires the compelling, the exploitation of another person, and that's where it's devoting substantial effort or energy to in terms of resources. It is taking those crimes. It is better defining those crimes. It is elevating those crimes in terms of classifications or appropriate sentences that would be imposed, including for some sections of it requiring registration as a sex offender. The only way in which it touches on prostitution is twofold. First, prostitution itself, there is an increase on the demand that is associated with any commercial sex act, but it does not impact the selling of commercial sex other than through sex trafficking. And then otherwise, in terms of prostitution, it also provides additional protections for individuals that are reporting sex trafficking so that they're not prosecuted for prostitution if they're reporting one of those crimes of sex trafficking or the patron of sex trafficking. And then last but not least, it also introduces the concept of being able to vacate previous convictions for prostitution if that individual was a victim of sex trafficking. So I would submit to you and the rest of the committee that this bill is doing precisely what you described, ensuring that resources are devoted to those areas that we're most concerned about for what I refer to as modern day sex slavery, but does not negatively impact individuals that are engaged in prostitution on their own. I will note it is still illegal under Alaska law. It was prior to this. It would be after this. That's not changing in any way, shape, or form. But it does devote all of the other resources being directed towards the sex trafficking. So that's the way that I would answer your question.
Follow up?
Except to say that thank you. I appreciate the effort that goes in this, went into this proposed legislation. As a former prosecutor of sex crime cases, I do think it is important to try to maintain that focus in terms of prosecution and in law enforcement to focus much more obviously on the terrible crime of sex trafficking and not, like I said, demote so much resources to fighting the consensual acts of involved in prostitution, although, of course, as Mr. Skidmore notes, still illegal. Thank you.
Mr. Skidmore, one of the questions that I previously asked you, I'd like to ask for the record, and
sure.
So the public can follow along as well. Under the federal definition of human trafficking, it includes labor and sex trafficking,
mm-hmm.
and that is distinctly different from what is being offered in this bill.
Yes.
And I was rather confused by that because I'm one who likes consistency, but you gave an explanation as to why the department has chosen to have it distinctly different. Would you please clarify that for the committee?
Sure. So to the chair and the rest of the members of the committee, the rationale is that sex trafficking is seen as a more serious or significant violation. If you look at sex trafficking in the first or second degree, those are crimes that are elevated in classification as well as sentencing. In our sentencing statutes, 1255-125, the state of Alaska has chosen to carve out sentences for sex offenses in subsection I and associate greater penalties with them. So the crimes of sex trafficking in the first and second degree are crimes that then get prosecuted under that subsection I with those greater penalties. Human trafficking, because it's not a sex crime, does not deserve those enhanced provisions that the state of Alaska has created in subsection I. They would be in the typical classifications of crimes. When you have that separation and one set of conduct has a higher penalty, you cannot then have the overlap between the two because of the law would require the benefit to go to the defendant.
that when there is overlap and you have a higher level crime and a lower level crime that covers the same conduct, the defendant will always be punished with the lower level offenses because that's what the law requires when there is that overlap. So that's really what that difference is about.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair. You know, I'm looking at the sex trafficking, the first, second, third degree.
Mm-hmm.
And sex trafficking is sex trafficking is sex trafficking. So I'm a little, why do we have the second, third degree and not just all in the first degree? Let's make it serious. I mean, is it, help me understand and get my hands around why we want to break those out.
Through the chair to Representative Johnson, I appreciate that. Sex trafficking in the first degree is really targeted towards the most significant conduct, which is where you have someone that is being forced or threatened with force. In other words, you can cause someone to engage in sex trafficking through coercion or deception in different means. Force is but one of those types of ways. But force, because it involves force as we define it in the law, is really talking about harming somebody else, threatening to harm somebody else physically. That's seen as the most serious. And that's consistent with what current Alaska law says as well. So we're maintaining that differentiation of force. The second way that's included is when somebody is under the age of 20. That is a change that was actually implemented back in 2012. It was then Representative Les Guerra who offered an amendment to change it from age 18 up to age 20. And essentially the rationale was that someone under the age of 20 is still very close to when they had graduated from school, and the significant information that's out there and available about the developing of one's brain essentially says, look, people that are that young really are not are still very impressionable, and there needs to be additional protections provided for them. And there was a lengthy discussion about how laws treat people based on their ages and the various laws that do those things. That was something that ultimately ended up passing in the House and the Senate and then was ultimately signed by the governor back in 2012. And so it says that if the person that is induced or caused is under the age of 20, that then is the crime of sex trafficking in the first degree. And so it's drawing a distinction between those individuals that may be induced or caused to engage in sex trafficking other than by force, but by deception or coercion. Those then get treated as sex trafficking in the second degree. So it really creates that distinction. Now, the third subcategory here that's in the bill talks about managing, supervising, controlling, or owning, either alone or in association with others, a prostitution enterprise or a place of prostitution. And in that situation, what you're really talking about is not the single individual that is engaged in prostitution for themselves, but now you have people that are coming together and this becomes a larger situation. It would sort of be akin to the ways in which we deal with drug trafficking. There is a crimes for distribution of drugs, and then there is crimes for an enterprise when it comes to distribution of drugs. And the enterprises or that greater activity that's grouped together in a single instance is always treated more harshly than are the others. So sex trafficking in the second degree, I've talked about force, I've talked about the underage or in the person's legal custody. I may have omitted that one. So it's under age 20 or in the person's legal custody. All of that is what gets categorized as the first degree. The second degree is then really about all those other ways in which somebody can be coerced or induced. And as Ms. Schroeder talked about, on page 4 and 5, you have the factors for inducing or causing. And this is the exposing of confidential information or a secret, whether true or false, that would subject a person to hatred, contempt, or ridicule, all the different ways that coercion can occur. This is really the typical sex trafficking that's within that degree. And then that's separated from the third degree, where these are individuals that are not the person that is compelling the other person to engage in sex trafficking, but are rather the ancillary supporting characters, if you will. So the person that is providing security, the person that's providing transportation, not the person in charge, but the person that's providing those supporting services. That still needs to be addressed, but that shouldn't be addressed in the same way as the person who's in charge. And so that's really what those different degrees try to delineate.
Follow up.
And I understand the definition, but everything you described to me is pretty heinous. I mean, all the crimes. And so I'm wondering why we're softer on something that's equally bad or just slightly worse or slightly better, and why we're not trying to, I guess maybe I'm trying to be a little tougher on it than the bill is, but why we're not saying if you traffic sex trafficking, it's the first degree. So that's kind of the question.
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, I understand what you're describing to me, and I can only tell you two things. First, in Alaska statutes, we often deal with degrees where there is a variation in the conduct, and we say, well, this conduct's a little more serious or this conduct's a little less serious. And when that occurs, we separate the classifications. So it's that same pattern or that same concept that's repeated itself here. That would be the first thing I would say. And the second thing I would say is I think that's also fairly consistent with what I have seen from the federal government or other states that approach those things. I don't mean to discount what you're describing. I'm merely describing to you why we chose to do it that way. Ultimately, whether or not this is adopted and what it looks like when it's adopted, we fully recognize from the administration that's a policy call for you all in the legislature. And so if you all thought it should all be treated exactly the same, that's certainly something that you could do. You would then have to decide which classification was appropriate for it. But this is what the administration proposed, and the rationale was this is the way we approach criminal conduct otherwise within our statutes, as well as this is what we've seen other jurisdictions do when they approach sex and human trafficking.
Just maybe a statement. To me, this is like being shot or stabbed.
Either way, you're going to die.
Either way, you've trafficked in sex. So I appreciate your explanation. I understand the consistency, but this is a terrible crime. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you, through the chair. Is slavery illegal in Alaska?
Slavery illegal in Alaska. Through the chair to Representative Eastman, the term slavery we would need to define to make sure that we're talking about the same thing, but I would generally tell you I think that slavery would be illegal under the current human trafficking laws and would still be illegal under these laws. But if there's some other nuance to that, then you and I would have to talk about what you mean when you say the word slavery, because I want to make sure we're talking about the same conduct.
Can I follow up? Yeah, and I think we're on the same page. And when I hear human trafficking, I hear slavery, I generally think of the same things. Now, earlier you were making a distinction between human trafficking and sex trafficking.
Yes.
And I think the word you used was typical with regard to human trafficking, and I'm not usually used to hearing someone talk about typical slavery. And so why are we making this distinction between slavery, which is really bad, mm-hmm. and maybe some form of sex slavery, which is really bad, mm-hmm. and why would we relegate one to the category of typical versus something that is in need of more penalties and harsher treatment?
So through the chair, Representative Eastman, I apologize. I don't recall when I used the word typical. I may well have done that. But the distinction that really exists between human trafficking and sex trafficking is the difference between labor trafficking and trafficking forcing somebody to engage in sexual conduct. And what I was describing is that our statutes already create separation between sexual conduct and other types of bad conduct, and that our statutes have applied a higher penalty to the sexual conduct. So that's the 1255-125 subsection I that expressly provides for greater penalties for that sexual conduct. In addition to that, we also recognize that certain crimes are what we call registrable sex offenses, so that there's additional requirements in terms of what that person has to do after being convicted. It's those distinctions that cause us to separate the two. And it's not to be one's more typical than the other. It's just different types of conduct. Both bad, that's why it's both criminalized, but under our current statutes already, we draw a distinction between those. This bill simply is following along with those distinctions that are drawn in our statutes as they exist today.
Thank you. Follow up. I don't know that maybe the distinction between labor trafficking and slavery is lost on me. I think maybe it sounds nicer than what it actually is. I'm not sure that we should be following that distinction in these other statutes. You know, for example, obviously you have registration for sex offenses and such. I would not certainly be opposed to registration for slave owners, for example, if that's something that is in your criminal past. Has there been a lot of thought put into this, or did we just borrow the template from our other statutes and sort of apply it in this situation?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, I don't think this is the sort of thing where we're just borrowing a template. We are using the structures that are already built in. I would tell you that human trafficking is treated more significantly in this bill. If we go back, for example, if I can refer you to page 5 of the bill, section 6, you'll note that human trafficking in the first degree is currently on line 17, classified as a Class A felony. We change that to make human trafficking in the first degree an unclassified felony. So we're raising the penalties for that. If you then go to human trafficking in the second degree, and I'm going to take you to page 6 for that one, this time line 11, you'll note that human trafficking in the second degree is under current law a B felony. This bill makes that an A felony. So I believe that the law is, in this bill, appropriately addressing the horrendous conduct that occurs. The unclassified crime is the highest level of crime that we have in our state. So, for example, human trafficking would then be subject to a sentence of somewhere between 5 and 99 years in the first degree. In the second degree, moving it from the B felony to the A felony, again, is substantially increasing the penalties associated with that. So I do believe that the bill is treating them appropriately in terms of the heinousness or the seriousness. Again, I would tell you that our laws have substantial structure or framework within them in which we differentiate between sex offenses and non-sex offenses. This follows along with that framework. Do I think there's a lot of thought that's gone into that? The answer is yes.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Paula?
I wanted to turn for a moment to, since we're on section page 6 of the bill, line 25.
Line 25. I'm with you.
And the title of that section is Corroboration of Certain Testimony Not Required.
Yes.
Can you speak a little bit more about why we would not be wanting to require corroboration of a crime, for example? What is the legal significance of this language that we would be adding to statute?
Through the chair to Representative Eastman, you're not actually adding a statute. You're taking a statute that already exists in the statute books today, and you're simply moving it to a different place. So okay. that requirement of a statute that says certain testimony is not required to be corroborated, that's a statute that exists today. I believe that that statute was adopted in response to case law that had been handed down at some point in the past. So this is expressing that concept that corroboration is not necessary. That does not in any way, shape, or form, however, change a prosecutor's obligation to prove something beyond a reasonable doubt. And if a jury says, you know what, I need corroboration for this, then we would still be needed to present that corroboration. However, it is not an element. It's not something that says without corroboration, you can't convict. In other words, this is a question for the jury to decide. Is the evidence enough for them? Yes or no? That's all that this means.
Follow up. And is that, you know, non-requirement of corroboration, is that true of other crimes as well? Or what is it that would make this crime specific? You know, this, I think we're in the human trafficking section. Maybe it applies elsewhere, though. Why is it appropriate in this specific instance if it's not appropriate to other crimes as well?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, that same concept applies elsewhere. The case law that I recall reading was case law that actually discussed whether or not someone that was a prostitute could be trusted or believed. That's what the case law talked about. And this was in direct response to saying, nope, every person in society has the ability to come forward and we should be treating them equally. And that's what this is trying to say.
Very good. Thank you. Follow up. I wanted to go back to the commercial sex act definition. And
page 11?
Yes, I think it is on page 11.
Okay.
And there's a couple of things there. So first, the definition offered here seems somewhat strangely specific and somewhat weird. What does a shared residential residence, why is that here?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, there was a bill that you may or may not recall. It was called SB 91 that went through the legislature a number of years ago. And at the time that that went through, the same organization that Representative Groh has mentioned that's coming around and talking to people that represent sex workers was in the building at that time as well. And they were coming through and they were complaining that they thought the sex trafficking statutes were going to improperly penalize sex workers who were simply sharing an apartment, that were roommates, nothing more than that. This was the language that was enacted by the legislature at that time to try to appease those concerns. And so what it means is that let me just read the definition. Commercial sex act means a sexual act for which anything of value is given or received by any person. That's that commercial transaction back and forth. What they did not want to include within that was whether or not you have roommates that are sharing a location that are then pooling their resources to pay for utilities, rent, what have you. That's not meant to be covered by this concept of anything of value that's given or received for a sex act.
Follow up.
All
right. So thank you for the history there. So you can perform a commercial sex act, which would normally be illegal, but it's legal if you're doing it for room and board or for room. Or what's an example where this would actually happen so that I know what we're talking about here?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, I'm afraid I don't know if I can give you precise examples. Those may be questions you'd have to ask somebody else. This definition is not making it legal. It's simply saying it does not qualify as that commercial sex act. The definition of prostitution would still make it illegal for one person to engage in a sex act in exchange for something of value. But the commercial sex act here that we're talking about is a term that's used in sex trafficking. It's to ensure that prostitutes that are sharing a residence together don't end up being charged for sex trafficking simply because they're sharing a residence, as opposed to making sure that we're only targeting those people that are compelling others to engage in the conduct. I know it can be somewhat confusing. I can only tell you this was the agreement or this was the resolution that was reached a number of years ago. And as we've attempted to update our statutes, we are not trying to abandon those previously achieved agreements or resolutions.
Thank you. Follow up?
Follow up.
All right. For my own part, this doesn't quite answer the question, but maybe I can talk to you more offline. It just kind of sounds to me like as long as the pimp's living under the same roof, that somehow it's not going to be treated like it normally would, which seems odd. But more on the mention earlier on commercial sex, I think we were defining it earlier, we were talking about how, you know, if there's selling involved, then now we're doing things that would trigger the sex trafficking and so forth, as long as there's selling involved. I wanted to know, does the definition of selling, is that broad enough to include things like trading victims? You know, maybe there's no money changing hands, but you're trading victims, and so there's some type of commercial transaction still happening.
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, I was with you up until the point where you said trading victims. If there is any sort of transaction and there's anything of value that is transferred between the two people for that sex act, that qualifies as commercial sex act. I'm not sure when you talk about trading of victims, what's happening in that particular scenario. That's the part where you lost me.
So you can picture sex trafficking as selling someone for a dollar, or you can picture sex trafficking as selling someone in response, in exchange for a pimp has someone else that, you know, is their victim, and now the two pimps are trading victims. That's the type of trading that I'm talking about.
So what through the chair, if I may, what I think you're asking me, I want to make sure I have this right. You're talking about two different pimps who each have people that they are trafficking, and instead of giving one another money, they just say, I'll let you have sex with my victim if you let me have sex with your victim.
Something like that.
Yes, I think that would qualify as something of value.
Okay, thank you very much. Follow up if I can.
Follow up.
We talked about school bus drivers not being allowed to be school bus drivers if they're convicted of these offenses. That seemed very specific. And I don't have the statute in front of me to be able to look at it, but would that also preclude someone from being a school bus attendant? I know a lot of our school buses have a driver and an attendant. They both work for the school bus.
Through the chair to Representative Eastman, the particular subsection or the statute that you're referring to is one that addresses school bus drivers. I'm unaware if it covers attendants as well. It was a conforming statutory change, language that was already there that said if you're convicted of certain types of crimes, because we were moving them from one section to another, that conforming change was made. The only thing that we added to it was if you were a patron of a victim of sex trafficking, because it follows along in that same concept. But this was not an attempt to make further policy determinations about those individuals that come into contact with kids on the way to school. It was simply taking what is currently in statute and following that same structure. I understand the difference that you're describing to me. I don't know what statutes there are to address that. That's not my area of expertise. I can just tell you that this is a statute that comes up when we do legal searches for where is this particular statute on sex trafficking that currently exists, where is it cited in statutes throughout the entire code. This was one of those locations. So that's why we make the changes that we do there. I'm afraid I can't answer the other substantive parts of your question.
Thank you. One more follow-up, if I may.
Follow-up.
So reckless disregard is the language in the bill, and I wanted to – could you please unpack that for us? What does it mean to engage in this conduct with reckless disregard for the fact that someone is a victim of sex trafficking? How is reckless disregard different than normal disregard or whatnot? I just don't understand the distinction.
Through the chair to Representative Eastman, this goes back to those concepts that all crimes have two basic elements that the state has to prove. One is called the mens rea or the actus. Excuse me, the mens rea or the mental element, and the second one is the actus reus or the act itself. And so when we talk about the mental state, reckless is one of those terms. And we define reckless by Alaska Statute 1181-900 subsection A3. And what it says recklessly is when someone is aware of and consciously disregards a substantial or unjustifiable risk that the result will occur or that the circumstance exists. And the risk that this person is disregarding must be of such a nature and degree that the disregard of it constitutes a gross deviation from the standard of conduct that a reasonable person would observe. And so what you're really talking about here is when you have that person that is purchasing sex from someone, they have to have a reckless disregard as to whether or not that person is a victim of human trafficking. That is, they have to disregard the substantial and unjustifiable risk that that person is in fact a victim of sex trafficking. And this goes back to the question that Representative Rowe was asking us, how would you establish that? And so you would go back to those factors or elements that are found in section 4 of the bill that were laid out for how people are coerced. These are the types of things that someone would have to look at, and they would be disregarding it. And that disregard would be of such a nature that it's a gross deviation from the standard of the reasonable person. Would a reasonable person in that situation look at this person that they're purchasing sex from and go, I don't think this person's doing this voluntarily. There's something else here that suggests to me this person's doing this against their will. Is it, as Ms. Schroeder indicated, is it that there's some security standing there watching over them? Is it that they're forcing them to do something? Is there something else that says, I don't think this person's really doing this of their own? That's what we'd be required to prove beyond a reasonable doubt, that mens rea when they engage in that actus reus of the actual purchasing of sex.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Skidmore. We have a few minutes left of committee, and this is a 33-page bill. I have taken lots of notes on this. This is a topic that is near and dear to my heart, and I've sat in this committee for the past 3 years where it has not gotten the attention that is needed, and I intend to change that in this committee. Thank you, Mr. Skidmore and Ms. Schroeder, for coming and presenting that this important bill for us today, and questions from committee members, because they have been a lot of the same questions that I have had. And we are going to have a Justice and Human Trafficking Week next week here in House Judiciary, March 13th through the 17th. The 15th through the 17th, where we are going to hear from the Department of Public Safety. We're going to hear from the Council on Human and Sex Trafficking and their report and recommendations. We are going to hear from organizations who provide boots on the ground services for persons who have been trafficked. We are going to hear from survivors themselves. And I'd like to refer to them as survivors rather than victims, because many of them have regained their purpose in life and are thriving and are sharing their stories to help others be able to come out of trafficking and also help those of us in the public prevent it. So I encourage you to do homework on this bill. We will hear it again. But next week, I want us to be able to gain an understanding of how this is impacting people's lives, the full understanding of how bad the crimes are here in the state of Alaska that have gone untouched and unnoticed for a very, very long time. So that concludes our business for today. The House Judiciary Committee will meet again on Monday, March 13th at 1 p.m. to have an overview of the 2022 Governor's Council on Human and Sex Trafficking Recommendations Report by members of the Council and Alaska Department of Public Safety. Seeing there is no other business before the committee, we will adjourn. Let the record reflect, it's 2:54 p.m.